Good to see everyone. We are in Matthew 19. If you have your Bible, you can turn to it. Before we get into the sermon today, I wanted to mention what John mentioned, that we have a new Sunday school class starting up next week. It's called Fellowship and the Breath of Human Relationships. I know that title doesn't give you a good sense of what we're going to be talking about and covering, but next week, for instance, we're going to be talking about biblical manhood, womanhood. You know, what does the Bible say in terms of defining us as men and women? Eventually, we'll talk about singleness, talk about marriage, probably dating at some point, and then we'll talk about different aspects of human relationships. What does it mean to be brothers and sisters in Christ? What does fellowship look like? How do we, as Christians, interact with non-Christians? So a whole bunch of different topics. We're going to kind of see where it takes us, and I'll try to list the weekly topics starting next week as we go forward. That way, if there's a certain one that you want to jump into, you'll know what week it's coming up on, and you can come early. But that is starting next week, 10 o'clock a.m. Sundays. So plan for that. And I think we're going to run this probably till the beginning of summer. So it'll go on for a little bit. Just to pick up from where we were last week, we're still in our series that we titled The Hard Sayings of Jesus. And this week we hit another. I kind of knew this one was coming up too. Jesus talks about divorce here, and it's very challenging. It's one of those passages that Jesus doesn't talk a lot about marriage. He doesn't talk a lot about divorce, but when he does here, it really does mean something. It packs a punch. So I wanted to look at it, and I think it's an important topic for all society, for our society, especially today. They say that I was looking up different numbers, and I think most of us have heard that, you know, 40 or 50% of marriages end in divorce, and that's actually not an entirely accurate number. That's actually an estimate, a projection, and they say that projected out among people in certain age groups overall, they say about 40 or 50% are at risk for divorce. The actual numbers are that 22% of all married people are divorced. You know, they could be in situations where they're remarried, but basically one in every five who are married have been or are divorced, which is actually, 22% doesn't sound like a lot, but one in five is a lot. And, you know, probably when you think about the other families you know, your friends, their families, that's probably right in the range where it's about right. I know when I did youth ministry, I used to ask the youth group kids all the time. I said, well, you know, how many of your friends are, you know, families are divorced? And it was a lot. It was a lot. That doesn't change with us either. I know that I would like to think, well, because we're this next generation of Asians living in this country, and because we're Christians, that protects us. But apparently the numbers for Christians is about the same, that about 22%, we kind of fit into that. So there is a need for this particular teaching. I do want to say this, kind of walking into this. I know a lot of times when we talk about marriage and parenting or those types of things on a Sunday, the people who are married or in the process of parenting tend to pay attention, in which we as a people have distorted God's original design and intention for marriage. I think the second thing he shows us is the failure of marriage, the reason why marriages break up. And the third thing he shows us is that despite the distortions and the failures, marriage endures, that there's a durability to marriage and a necessity to it. So those are the three things we're going to look at: the distortion of marriage, the failure of marriage, and ultimately the durability of marriage. Okay, so we're going to start with the first one, the distortion of marriage. Let me go into verse 3. We're going to read down to verse 8. And I want you to pay attention again. Pay attention to Jesus' words, to what he's specifically saying. Okay, starting in verse 3, it says, "The Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, 'Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?' And this is what Jesus said, 'Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife and the two shall become one flesh? So they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate.' They said to him, 'Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away?' He said to them, 'Because of the heart, your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so.'" Okay, so let's track through and see what's going on. The whole conversation arises because the Pharisees want to trap Jesus. And they've done this in multiple places. They bring a question to Jesus, they ask him something, and the reason why they ask isn't to find out an answer. They want to seize upon Jesus if he says it a certain way or if he says certain things. And one of the things that Jesus has been actually accused of from time to time in his ministry is he's accused of not being faithful to God's word. And, you know, for us, we would think that's impossible. But if you imagine, you know, the Pharisees preached the law. Jesus went around and forgave. You know, he showed grace. He spoke about grace. He ate with sinners. And so the Pharisees actually had this notion that Jesus really wasn't, he really wasn't their kind of person. He's too soft on the law, too soft on sin. So they want to trap him, and what Jesus actually does is he gives them a more conservative answer than they expect. He actually is more adherent to God's plan than they would suspect. But I want you to listen to what Jesus says. You know, he answers these, and do you guys notice what he's quoting from here when he answers? Does anyone know? Looks very familiar, doesn't it? Genesis 1. Right, he's pulling from Genesis 1. That's what he's quoting. He's going all the way back to before the fall, and he says, you know, a man shall leave his father and mother, hold fast to his wife, two shall become one flesh. They are not two, but one. What God has joined together, let not man separate. So if you notice, it's pulling from Genesis 1. They say, wait. You know, Moses allowed us to get divorces. And of course, they're big about Moses. I mean, Moses is the man. You know, Moses is the most important figure in their history. He's the one who gave them the law. And they say, wait, that's wonderful, but didn't Moses say it was okay to divorce? And what is Jesus' response? He says, well, the reason why he did it was because of the hardness of your hearts. This isn't the way that it was meant to be. And that's essentially Jesus' answer. Jesus is showing them that that's not the way God intended it to be. He quotes Genesis 1. He says, this is the way that God originally intended it. He intended it so that a man would meet a woman, they would get married, and there would be no need for a divorce. And yet, because of your stubbornness, because of the hardness of your hearts, because of all the different things that have happened, it's allowed. But you see, that's Jesus' answer. Jesus' answer is, it was never supposed to be this way. It was never supposed to be this way. You know, God created men and women uniquely, and in this unique creation, they were to fulfill each other. And you know, again, that's what Genesis 1 speaks of, the fact that two become one flesh, and that what God had joined together, let no one tear apart. But the truth is, and all of us know this, is that after the fall in a sinful world, that doesn't happen anymore. It doesn't happen in bad marriages. It doesn't happen in good marriages either. You know, we know that marriages are supposed to be fulfilling. We know that they're supposed to be satisfying. We know that in them we're supposed to find a measure of comfort, a measure of fellowship, a matter of connection that we know should be there, and yet we don't, even in the best of marriages. Things are not the way that they are supposed to be. And I'll tell you, at least in our culture, one of the reasons why is because marriage has been distorted. It's been changed. It's been altered. In our culture, what are the distortions in our culture that, in terms of how we view marriage? Well, I'll tell you a couple very, very quickly off the top of our heads, on top of my head. I think one of the things that's happened in our culture is we've redefined marriage. In a very overt way, marriage is no longer simply between a man and a woman. We've opened it up, and we now allow that it can be between two men, it can be between two women. We've essentially redefined it. In addition, we no longer see it as sacred. You know, it's just a social contract. It's just a piece of paper. It's something the government lets us do. And in doing that, there's different contractual things of the way the government treats us, or things that we should expect of the government, those types of things. It's no longer about whole commitment either. And people go into marriage and they know that it's probably not going to last. Or people go into it knowing that they're not going to give everything of themselves, that they're going to hold back. Matter of fact, that's exactly what a prenuptial agreement is, isn't it? It's a statement that says, if at any time this happens, I reserve the right to pull back the things that I want to pull back. Well, what is that? That's essentially someone going into a marriage that is meant to be a whole life commitment saying, I'm not ready yet. Right? I mean, that's essentially what it is. You know, and we've redefined marriage and we've lost the idea that marriage is God's idea. Marriage is actually, it's when you look in the Bible, marriage is sacred. It involves a whole commitment, and we see that it's something that God put together. Matter of fact, the Bible has a word for this marriage vow or this connection. In the Old Testament, it's called a covenant. It's a promise. It's a promise that forever and ever and ever, this is how we're going to relate to each other. I am going to do this for you. I am going to be this for you. You are going to do this for me. You are going to be this for me. And we see that all through the Old Testament. You know, there's the idea of marriage is based in God, and it's this idea of covenant. You know, that it is sacred and that it cannot be broken. Another distortion that's happened outside of redefining marriage is in our culture, we've devalued marriage. You know, we've said essentially marriage really doesn't matter. And we've said that more and more. You know, and you hear that in people. You hear people say, well, it's just a piece of paper. And so we do have more and more people who never intend to get married. We also have more and more people who will not get married and yet live as if they are married. You know, they'll live together and they'll do all the married types of things. And they really see no importance in it. That's not just happening here, but they say, especially in Scandinavia, specifically Sweden, they've seen marriages drop drastically, more than 50% over a generation, which essentially means that what they project is in 20, 40 years, no one's going to get married anymore. And that's, you know, when they do interviews with young people in these areas, they talk about that, how there's really no purpose. They don't see a reason for it anymore. What we've done is we've devalued marriage. The funny thing is, people who say marriage isn't important still live as if they're married, don't they? They live together, they have kids, and they have the same expectations. They expect the same things from their spouse, and they expect that these commitments are going to go on forever. That tells me something very important. That tells me something that even when people say that it's not important, it is. It's embedded in their hearts. You know, they want that. They want the covenant. They want the commitment. They want all those things. And yet we've devalued it. I think another thing that's happened is we've lost the purpose of marriage. And I'm not going to talk too much about this, but I think something's happened in the modern mind that is actually very dangerous is at some point it shifted and people began to believe that marriage was about happiness. I hate to break everyone's romantic notions about what marriage is. Marriage is not about happiness. And, you know, the joke is you could ask any husband or wife, they say, of course it's not about happiness. Marriage is not about happiness, it's about holiness. And I'm not going to get too far into it, but if you go into marriage wanting happiness, you will not find it. You will actually find a lot of brokenness, a lot of sadness, a lot of frustration. If you go into marriage looking for holiness, you will end up being happy. But if you go into marriage wanting to be happy, you absolutely will not find it. And yet that's what everyone's looking for, isn't it? They're looking for happiness. They're looking for self-fulfillment. They're looking for something that's going to fix their lives. And marriage doesn't do that. Matter of fact, what do you think happens when you take one sinner, put them in a room with another sinner for a long period of time? More sin, more conflicts, more issues. And that's what you see. You see people who've been married a long time that sometimes they go, why did I get married? Life is so much harder. It is if you're looking for happiness. If you understand that God's purpose is holiness, you find happiness along with that. But if you look for happiness, you will not find it in marriage. So what's happened over time is we've redefined, we've devalued, and we've repurposed marriage, and it's destroying marriage. It's absolutely destroying us. But there is still a need. And the reason why that need is still there, the reason why we still want to act like we're married, the reason why we want to still live in these things that look like marriages is because marriage is rooted in the Trinity. Now, we believe in a Trinitarian God, and if you believe in a God who is three, then relationships are at the core of our being. Think about that for a second. If it was just God and he wasn't a Trinity, then we could be relational creatures. We could be non-relational creatures. But if you were created from a Trinity that created you in his image, then relationships are woven into the essence of who you are. That God's imprint on your heart is that you need and you want relationships. even for the person who says they would rather live alone, there's still a desperate need for a relationship, for human contact. And you know, that's how all of us are built. We're built for community and much more. We're built for commitment. We're built for oneness. And at the heart of that is God. We have this desire to know and be known. We have this need to love and be loved. And all that is rooted in the Trinity. So again, the first thing we see is that marriage has been distorted. We've misunderstood it. We've misused it. And because of that, we've essentially broken it. Okay? We've broken it. Second thing we see is the failure of marriage. If you go into verse 8, it says, if you look at Jesus, he says very carefully, he says, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. If you notice, he uses this concept of hardness of heart. He's talking in kind of two ways. In one sense, he's talking about the fact that they were stubborn and so he allowed it. But I think he's also talking about the reason why marriages break up. Now, a lot of times we want to say the problem with marriage is that marriage isn't, we want to say the problem with marriage is that it's just the cultural institutional thing and society's change. You know, society's changing today, and so our traditional idea of marriage doesn't work anymore. We need to rework that, and we need to refigure that out. And then once we adjust what marriage is, then it'll fit our society, it'll fit this modern notion. That's not the problem with marriage. The problem with marriage isn't that it's too traditional and needs to catch up with the times. There's other people who say the problem with marriage is we're just biologically not created for that. We're not biologically created to pick one person and spend the rest of our lives with them. That's not right either. There's a lot of problems with that understanding. What Jesus is saying here, I think, is that the reason why marriages fail and the reason why Moses allowed for divorce is this. The real reason behind all those problems is us, is you and me. It's our sin nature. It's sin. And again, I'm not giving you this shocking answer. You go, my gosh, that makes complete sense of my marriage now. Now I'll go out and I'll change everything. No, I mean it's relatively obvious. But I want you to walk through this with me. You know, Augustine said this. There was early Christianity, there was a big debate over what is the real heart or real core of sin. Augustine said it was this. He said, the real core of sin is pride. And I know that you might hear pride and think about certain actions, certain behaviors. Basically what he said the sin of pride is being consumed with love for yourself, right? I mean, when you're proud, that's what you do. You love yourself. Essentially, pride is selfishness. It's self-centeredness. It's living for yourself. It's loving yourself. It's treating yourself as if you were the king, as if you were the most important person in the world. Now, Augustine said it for this reason. He says, when you look at the fall of Lucifer, when you look at the reason why men and women fall, Adam and Eve fell, why did they all fall? Selfishness, self-centeredness, pride. Right? Lucifer said, I could be just like God. What did Adam and Eve say? Oh, if we eat this, we could be just like God. They fell. That's one of the reasons why, what is the great commandment? To love the Lord your God, not you. To love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Interesting, isn't it? Now, think about this for a second. Marriage and family strikes at the very heart of pride and self-centeredness. In other words, the moment you get married, all of your selfish desires and inwardness gets challenged. It might not get necessarily changed, but it gets challenged, right? You no longer can live and do things simply because you want to do them. You have someone else there. And all of a sudden, at the very least, you have to tell them. All of a sudden, you have someone else to consult. All of a sudden, there is someone else who is a part of your life who matters. And you need to begin to start making decisions based on that. What happens when you have kids? Strikes at the heart of your selfishness too, right? Because all of a sudden, you want to sleep, they don't. You know, they get up 3 times a night, hungry for food. What do? Turn to them, stop being so selfish. No? You say, you know what? I guess I'm not going to sleep tonight. Marriage, he's agreeing with me. Marriage and family strike at the heart of our selfishness. They challenge us because we can no longer live for ourselves. You know, in other words, the problem with marriage is my sin. And if that's true, then in any married, in any, with any issue in marriage, the husband and wife can both say, I am the problem in my marriage, and they're both right. They're both right. Either one can say at any moment, I am the problem in this marriage, and they're both right. That's just the way it is. I know that some of you who are single don't understand that. You go, no, if it's a problem, it's either me or it's spouse, right? No, when you get married, you'll understand. You can, at any time, you can look at each other and go, and both people can say, you know, the problem in the marriage is me. They can both say that, and they're both right. And when you get married, you'll realize that's absolutely true. The problem is that I'm a sinner, and that's rooted in my heart. And marriage is one of the ways that God roots it out. Let me explain this. When marriages fail, and I've known people who whose marriages have failed. I know people who are essentially waiting for their kids to leave the home so that they can dissolve the marriage. In any marriage failure, there's strong elements of self-centeredness, self-serving. For instance, you have a couple who says, well, we just wanted different things. Well, if you listen to that very carefully, what it means is, selfishly, I wasn't willing to subordinate my own goals. I wasn't willing to adjust, right? I mean, that's essentially what it means. Well, we just wanted different things. Well, selfishly, we weren't willing to conform, to let go of these things that I wanted to pursue over my lifetime. Or you have a couple who breaks up, marriage breaks up because of infidelity, because of adultery. Well, that's the pursuit of selfish pleasure, isn't it? It's a pursuit of selfish pleasure, neglecting what is good for the other person, seeking certain things outside of the proper avenue and not caring about how it's going to affect someone else. That's deeply selfish. You know, you can look at not even marriages that break up. You can look at marriages and that have problems, and you see this unwillingness to forgive, this unwillingness to adjust, this unwillingness to serve, this unwillingness to love. And why? Selfishness. Marriage challenges all of those things, because in a marriage, you are no longer two, but you become one. And that means that I am no longer this thing outside of my spouse. And that means that things change. That no longer do I live my life in a selfish, self-serving way. And there are, I mean, it breaks apart all the, you know, when people divorce, there are different things that they say. I remember someone once said to me, well, it's better for our children if they experience a divorce than if they experience a marriage where there's fighting and no love. And given those two options, maybe that's true, but it's much better for a child to be in a to be in a family where the two fight, but through their love for God, they begin to see a way through, and they begin to adjust, they begin to show compassion and grace and understanding. And then through that, they begin to be able to lay down their pride, to forgive, to serve, ultimately to love, isn't it? Of course. And that's, I'm saying these things not to say that there are no reasons to ever separate or divorce. I think that there are, I've never run into this, but actually, no, I have. I hate to say this, I have. But there are situations where physical abuse is involved or emotional abuse is involved that, but again, what are those? It's selfishness. You know, there are a few good reasons, but even those few good reasons, I mean, it's because of sin. That's not the way God designed it to be. God didn't design things in his world so that people would get married and then get separated and get divorced. That was never a part of God's design. So, now that I've depressed everyone, what good is there? Jesus talks about the durability of marriage. And you could say this is good, you could say this is bad, but let's look at verses 8 and 9. In verse 8, we're picking up what we read before, but Jesus says, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. Now, that's really scary, right? He's saying that Moses allowed it, but if you get divorced, God still sees you as being married. So if you get divorced and then you remarry, then you're committing adultery. And again, there's nuance to it. But what is he talking about? Well, he's talking about the durability of marriage. He's talking about the fact that two people can get divorced, but what? God still sees them as being married. And it's a very strange thing, right? It's a very strange thing. This is one of those passages, again, because we're talking about it in this series called Hard Sayings, this is always one of those things I kind of wrestled with. But what he's talking about is the fact that there is a spiritual weight, a spiritual significance to marriage that we don't understand. The marriage isn't simply a certificate. It's not a legal or a social contract. He's saying that there is a spiritual significance to marriage, that it is what we were talking about before, that it's a covenant. And he's saying that this is something that doesn't simply end because you tear up a piece of paper, or because you sign a piece of paper, or because you move out of your house. This is something that by nature is rooted in God and the heart of God and the plans of God. And that's serious business, isn't it? You know, I don't know if I can explain all of it, but what I can say is this. If that's true, and it is because Jesus talks about it, if that's true, then it means that we need to take marriage much, much more seriously, doesn't it? You know, so for instance, you know, if you're someone who's single, I think that should affect the way that you look for a spouse. You know, a lot of times I think for single people, when you're looking for a spouse, you're looking for a couple of characteristics, or you're looking for a couple things that are pleasing to you, whether that's physical attraction or whether that's certain personality traits and compatibility, I guess is the word that's used most often. But when you think about it, like physical attraction or certain types of compatibility are very, very superficial, aren't they? I mean, right? I mean, that's one of the things that happens. If you walk into a room full of single people, I mean, you immediately X some people out, and you immediately kind of pay attention to other people, and it's usually for very superficial reasons. It's not because you've dug into their history and you know what kind of person they are. You simply scan the room, you go, 1, 2, 3, okay, let me see how things shake out, right? Well, I mean, there's not a lot to that, is there? You know, if there is really a seriousness and a depth and a meaning to marriage, I think sometimes it means that we have to readjust the way that we look at people. You know, it means that we're not simply looking for the few things that when we walk into a room, flag people and say, oh, okay, maybe that person. Matter of fact, I think Tim Keller says this to his singles in his church, and I think it's a great way to say it, but he said multiple times, he said, there are people that you wouldn't give a second thought to that you should think about marrying. You know, that there are some people that you would naturally skip over because they don't fit certain qualifications that would be great people for you to marry. And you know, we don't think about that, do we? Unfortunately, we don't. You know, we tend to look at the few things that are there, but if it is spiritually significant, if it is spiritually meaningful, and if it's spiritually lasting like this, then we need to consider other things. We need to consider depth of character. We need to consider spirituality. And we need to consider these things that don't reveal themselves in the first viewing, in the second viewing, in the third viewing. Now, we need to think about things that sometimes we need to get to know people for a while and peer into to see other things that matter, like compassion, like servanthood, like love for God. And when you begin to start seeing those things matter, don't they? You know, if you're someone who's already married, what a lot of these things mean is it means that if marriage is spiritual, if it's enduring like this, then if you're married, then it means that we need to take seriously the work of working on our marriage. And when I say working on our marriage, it isn't the idea of working on my spouse, because that's the easy thing to do, right? Well, how are you going to work on your marriage? Well, if my spouse, if she just, or if he just, then that would make everything great. No. You know, the hard work of marriage is working on your own heart. In any problem, both people can say at the exact same time, I am the problem in this marriage, and they're both right. And so in taking marriage seriously as a married person, the work that God gives us is to work on our own hearts. And there are genuine things to disagree about. There are genuine things to fight about. There are genuine things that are a little bit more on one spouse than another. But I think what God calls us to do is he calls us to deal with our hearts first. He calls us to deal with our problems first and then enter into the problem. And if we take the work, if we take marriage seriously, then we take the work of marriage seriously too. Now, as we close, I want to say this, and this was really the part that I wrestled hard with this week. There is a paradox in what Jesus says. Okay, so I've just told you that what Jesus is saying here is that marriage is a lot more durable than you and I understand. You can get divorce papers, but in God's eyes, you're not divorced, right? That's kind of what he's saying here. Here's the other thing. Jesus talks about marriage this other time, and if you remember, it comes up with the Sadducees. The Sadducees come to see Jesus, and they say, Jesus, we have a question about the resurrection. Okay, pretend you have a man here, a man and a woman, they get married, man dies, she marries his brother, he dies, marries another brother, he dies, marries another brother, he dies, you know, she's going through the whole family, right? Marries this other brother, he dies, when she gets to heaven, who's he married to? And, you know, this is one of those questions that trap him. Do you remember what Jesus says? He says, in heaven, you don't understand, in heaven, no one is given into marriage, there is no marriage. Isn't that weird? He says there's a durability to marriage, but in heaven there isn't going to be any. Right? It's really, really strange. What does that mean? It means that marriage has a unique purpose here on earth that will be fulfilled in heaven, so we won't need it. The reason for marriage here will be fulfilled, and so it'll be unnecessary there. Right? Does that make sense to you guys? You guys following me? Does that, yes, no, maybe, I don't know. Kind of that makes sense? Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense. I try to be a logical guy, and I try to make sense in my head, and that makes sense to me. So marriage is meant for here. There's something about it that does something here. Now, when you go in Ephesians, we see that our marriages are meant for other people, right? You know, that people see in a good marriage, they see Christ in the church. And that's an important aspect of it. I also said earlier that marriage is for holiness, that God puts you in a marriage and it's to make you holy. And obviously when you get to heaven, God transforms you. You no longer need for holiness. So that's part of it. There's another part, and this is the part I wanted to address at the end. There's another part of the purpose of marriage, and it's this. Marriage is meant to be a signpost. It's meant to be a taste or a preparation for something else, something greater. You know, it's meant to be a glimpse of something that's yet to come. You know, what Jesus says is he quotes Genesis 1, and he says, marriage was not supposed to be something that you could jump into and jump out of. It wasn't supposed to be something that on a fling in a drunken stupor in Las Vegas, you could stand in a chapel and get married and, you know, all those types of things. Jesus is saying that behind marriage, there is supposed to be something in which there is a unique relationship that is unbreakable. You know, there's supposed to be a human relationship in which love so completely both fills and transforms. And, you know, what marriage shows us as believers is meant to show us the love that God has for us. You know, in the Bible, I think most people miss this. In the Old Testament, God takes marriage vows. You ever realize that? There's actually not just one place, there's actually multiple places in the Old Testament where God takes marriage vows himself. You don't have to turn to it right now, but if you go to Genesis 12, if you go to Genesis 15, and then if you actually look through the rest of the Old Testament from Genesis 12 on, you see it once in a while. And it's called the covenant. God takes marriage vows, and what does he say? I will be your God, and you will be my people. God takes marriage vows, and if you notice, all through the Old Testament, those vows are never broken. God is always faithful, always true to them, even when his people run. Matter of fact, there's a wonderful story in Hosea. God tells Hosea the prophet to go find a wife. He finds a wife. And the wife runs off, leaves Hosea, leaves her husband, throws herself headlong into prostitution. And God speaks again to Hosea. He says, Hosea, go. Get her back. Pay her debts and love her again. Take her as your own. Now, would you ever do that? Would you ever marry someone and if he or she ran off, threw himself, herself into prostitution and sleeping around, would you ever go rescue them and say, hey, please come back, be my husband, be my wife, and let's continue to build this marriage? I don't know if anyone would. But God asks Hosea to do it. Why? Because it's a picture of his love for us. Now, God takes marriage vows in the Old Testament, and that's one of the reasons why in Ephesians 5, he says marriage is about Christ and the church. That's why Jesus says that he's the groom and his church is the bride. That's not a random metaphor. It's because God has taken his vows. He says through rich and poor, sickness and health, when you are faithful, when you're unfaithful, I will be your God, you will be my people. See, all of it is meant to show us that there is a love. There is an unbreakable, everlasting love that will fill us, that will transform us, that will make us completely different people. And that love itself is a love that we find only in Jesus Christ. And you know, the very unique thing about it is Jesus doesn't just win us to love. He doesn't just say, hey, I have this love waiting for you, come and get it. He wins us by love, by giving his own life. Jesus says this. He says, maybe a friend would die for a friend, give his life for a friend of his. But what does Jesus do? Well, like in the story of Hosea, Jesus doesn't die for a friend. On the cross, he dies for us. We are prostitutes. We are people who have whored ourselves to other idols, to other gods, who live in hatred to God. And yet, it's that love that has come to save us. And you see, when you understand that that's the love behind you, behind your faith, behind your life, it becomes the love behind your marriage. And that's the only way your marriage survives. Marriage isn't just durable because God says, even when you get divorced, I say it's still there. Marriage is durable and it's purposeful because it's meant to show us there's a greater love waiting for us. And in Jesus, in God, that will never be broken. He will never divorce us. He will never leave us. Nothing will ever separate us from him because he is our God and we are his people. Let's pray together.